Support for this podcast is provided by the Tax Attorney Recruiting Event. Are you looking to hire talented tax attorneys for your practice? Scheduled for Thursday, February 23rd, 2023, TARE, the largest tax attorney recruiting event in the country, brings together more than 150 graduate students from top-ranked tax LLM programs at the University of California Irvine School of Law, Boston University School of Law, the University of Florida Levin College of Law, and Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, allowing them to interview for positions with tax employers. Through TARE, employers will have the opportunity to pre-screen applications and select candidates with whom they wish to interview. Employers who wish to participate in TARE should visit the-tare.com. That's the-tare.com.
Welcome to Tax Notes Talk, a podcast from Tax Notes, the leading source of tax news, information, and analysis.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm David Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of Tax Notes Today International. This week, iTaxpayer, Part 1. As the labor market remains tight, and as companies seek to fill their needs through increased use of automation and robots, now seems like an appropriate time to revisit the question of whether and how robots should be taxed. To explore two perspectives on this issue, we're dedicating the next two episodes of Tax Notes Talk to highlighting some of the arguments for and against the taxation of robots. This week's episode, Part 1, features Professor Ryan Abbott discussing the merits of taxing robots. Next week's episode, Part 2, features Professor Orly Mazur raising concerns over what a robot tax could do. Tax Notes contributing editor Marie Sapiri will join us for some background on the issue in just a minute. Later in the episode, we'll hear from Tax Notes federal author Elizabeth Stevens about an article she co-authored on transfer pricing's next generation of leaders. But first, Marie, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand this is a big topic with many different arguments for and against. Could you give us a preview of the issues you covered in your interviews?
So like you mentioned, my interview with Ryan is the first half of a two-part series on how tax policy might address the societal and economic changes that automation could cause. In these two interviews, we go over key parameters of the debate over how the tax system might change in the wake of increasing automation, including the relevant definitions, such as what exactly is a robot tax, what options there are for policymakers to consider, and how to choose among them, and also implementation questions.
Now, what makes this issue important to talk about today?
So that's a question that our guests this week and next week will address in detail. But briefly, the big concern is that if automation causes large-scale unemployment, then the tax bases that governments rely upon will be dramatically reduced. The debate over tax policy really took off in 2017 when the European Parliament considered and rejected a robot tax proposal. That proposal suggested a tax on the owners of robots to fund support for workers whose jobs were reduced or eliminated by robots. But the more general question of how policymakers should respond to a period of time where rapid technological changes appear highly likely and the effects of those changes are not really certain is more of a perennial issue historically. You can see that illustrated in the EU's proposal, which opens with references to the story of Pygmalion from classical antiquity and Mary Shelley's famous creature in Frankenstein, which was published over 200 years ago. And while we aren't dealing with Greek goddesses changing marble sculptures into living women or monsters who mine Plutarch for tips on how to be a noble human, we do seem to be in a period of rapid adoption of automation now, and that's why the tax considerations are a current issue. Also, it's worth noting that the EU's proposal was part of a broader package that was intended to regulate the widespread adoption of robots. So it focused on non-tax items like the formation of a regulatory body dedicated to robotics and artificial intelligence, an ethical framework for developing and using robots, and liability in situations where robots were involved. The tax implications were not really the main focus there, but the proposal pointed out that if the concerns about potential widespread unemployment came to be, then maintaining the current basis of taxation could result in a big increase in inequality, as well as endanger social welfare and the social security systems.
So I take it that this is not just any one country's issue. This is more of a global question.
That's right. It's definitely a worldwide debate. As I mentioned, there was the EU proposal, which wasn't enacted, but also in 2017, South Korea announced that it would reduce the deduction for investments in automation equipment that businesses could take on their corporate taxes. South Korea's deduction was due to expire that year, so the proposal was to extend the deduction but reduce it.
Now, you spoke with both Ryan and Orly about this. This week we'll be hearing from Ryan. Could you tell us about Ryan and what sort of things you talked about?
I spoke with Ryan Abbott, a law professor at the University of Surrey and the author of the recent book, The Reasonable Robot, Artificial Intelligence and the Law. Ryan is also the co-author of the article, Should Robots Pay Taxes? Tax Policy in the Age of Automation, which was published in the Harvard Law and Policy Review in 2018. He's a licensed attorney, physician, and acupuncturist in the US, and a solicitor advocate in England and Wales. Last year, he led a team of lawyers and researchers in successfully acquiring a patent in South Africa for a technology that was designed and created by an AI system. This was notable because the named patent inventor was the AI system. So he's been thinking about a wide variety of the legal aspects of increased automation. In this interview, Ryan and I discussed the history of the proposals to implement a robot tax, the rationale and possible objections to the proposals, possible policy options for an automation tax, and also some of the other areas of the law that automation implicates.
All right, let's go to that interview.
Thank you, Ryan, for joining me today to discuss the tax policy choices that lie ahead in an increasingly automated economy.
Thank you. Very exciting to be here.
So you've been thinking and writing about this topic for a while now, including in a 2018 article titled Should Robots Pay Taxes, in which you and your co-author wrote that we need to take at least an automation-neutral approach in our tax policies. So to set the stage, would you explain what is meant by the term robot tax?
Sure. And, you know, just to be clear, I'm not a tax person. In fact, I don't even do my own taxes. But this was an area of particular interest to me because it reflects a broader philosophy I have about the fact that people and machines can both end up doing the same thing, and yet the law applies very differently to those behaviors. So an example I give in the tax context is, you know, if my university manages to replace me with a robot, which they will when the student's satisfaction scores come out the same, they don't have to make payroll taxes for me. So our tax policies are encouraging businesses to automate even when it might not be more efficient. And so a robot tax is a potential solution to that problem. You know, in a narrow sense, it could refer to a specific form of taxation on specifically robots or more broadly automation equipment. Or my co-author and I came to the conclusion that what was really needed was more tax neutral laws between labor and capital taxes.
So one of the underlying concepts in many of the proposals to tax robots and automation is the idea of a robot worker. If Congress were to take up the idea to implement a robot tax, how should it define what a robot worker is? And what are the policy implications of choosing the definition?
Sure. No, well, that's a great question. And I think it's one of the reasons why a narrower understanding of robot tax would be a difficult and problematic thing to implement. If one has concerns about businesses being driven to automate, you know, given current tax preferences for automation equipment, a potential solution to that is to try and come up with a tax on automation equipment and robots that is replacing human workers or that could be doing the job of a human worker. But it's a very difficult thing to define that. And it's also something that would be subject to a lot of administrative overhead and gamesmanship. So machines or robots don't always replace people on a one-to-one basis. They're not always physically embodied. They're not always doing things interchangeably with a person. So that's one of the reasons why I think a narrow robot tax has a lot of hurdles ahead of it that make a broader rebalancing of capital and labor taxation more interesting.
History includes many examples of technological developments that have had a major impact on the course of human lives, and increasing automation seems likely to be one of those types of changes. Where did the idea to tax automation originate, and how has it developed?
Well, there has been a scattering of people in older literature referring to the sorts of issues that we've more recently been looking into, but this concept of a robot tax really emerged with a report by the European Commission in 2017 suggesting that automation had social concerns associated with it, and that one solution might be to have a robot tax on owners of automation equipment to fund support for retraining of workers put out of jobs by robots. You know, that got a lot of attention, including from Bill Gates and Lawrence Summers. And that was in 2017. And it really sparked a discussion about how we tax people and machines and more broadly, the structure of the tax system.
Support for this podcast is provided by SafeSend. The lack of qualified candidates continues to cause issues in the profession, but progressive firms are empowering admin with tax automation software to do the heavy lifting. The SafeSend suite will save your admin staff hours on assembly, delivery, and e-signing of tax packages, saving money and making staff happier. And your staff deserve the sweet life this coming busy season. Schedule a demo to experience this workflow automation solution for yourself at safesend.com. That's safesend.com.
Would you tell us about the rationale for changing the tax laws in response to increased automation?
Sure. Well, different people have had different rationales for doing it. So as I just mentioned, the European Commission is concerned about having less competition for human workers and some of the undesirable effects of technological unemployment or people being put out of work due to automation equipment. So a robot tax that makes automation costlier would disincentivize employers to render people technologically unemployed. A tax on automation equipment could also be used to fund enhanced social benefits or to retrain workers. Historically, automation equipment has put swaths of people out of work, but in the short term. And in the long term, productivity has increased and people have gone on to find new types of work. But as a society, we haven't done a great job of transitioning people. You know, that dates back to the Industrial Revolution and the first major wave of automation. You know, as an example, at the turn of the 19th century, 40% of the workforce was in agriculture, and now it's 3%, and we don't have 37% unemployment. You know, that 3% is dramatically more productive, and the 37% of others have gone on to find other sorts of work. So even if it works out well on the whole for society, a tax like that could help to soften the cushion for the people who are being adversely affected by it. My co-author, Brett Bogenschneider, and I argued that another reason to have an automation tax was that there's a lot of reasons to automate or not automate, you know, including due to COVID, there's labor shortages or for health reasons, but for all sorts of reasons. One reason why we would argue businesses shouldn't be automating is that, you know, if they're just doing it to save on taxes, if McDonald's is using machines instead of cash registers, not because it's a better consumer experience or it's safer or it's faster, or Tesla's using a self-driving car because it's safer, but just not to have to pay a taxi driver taxes for hiring a taxi driver. So we argue that tax policy should be neutral toward the actor doing the productive work, you know, and that is reflected in, again, for example, payroll taxes being required for a person, but not a machine doing functionally exactly the same activity.
So in the case of a short-term disruption, like you mentioned, does that lend to an argument that a robot tax should be time-limited or targeted in some way?
It could. You know, it depends on the social values underlying how you decide to structure a tax system. If, for example, in the next 5 or 10 years, the only industry that is really affected by automation is the transportation industry, say most truck drivers are put out of work, one could target robot taxes to self-driving vehicles or towards transportation industry generally or toward trucking companies. And that would, you know, have the effect of the benefited parties bearing the cost of helping to smooth the transition for those being negatively affected. In my view, though, having automation neutral tax policies is a generally useful sort of thing because, again, it gets rid of some perverse incentives that encourage people to automate to avoid paying their fair share of taxes.
In your 2018 article, you included 5 possible policy options for an automation tax. Would you walk us through those options?
Sure. Well, you know, it starts by recognizing the different ways that people and machines are subject to taxes, or really where employers are subject to different tax treatment for using people versus machines for certain activities. So payroll taxes is one, but changing the accelerated, you know, changing deductions for using machinery or other sorts of automation equipment, or changing the timing of deductions. And also employers can benefit from not having to bear the indirect tax consequences of higher taxes on human labor. So we propose basically going through those and trying to create offsetting taxes on automation equipment that might be used for phasing out deductions, for example, that businesses use for automation equipment, you know, to something equivalent to a payroll tax on a business for the level of using a machine. Or having, you know, and that's one view, and another view is to have something like an automation tax, something like unemployment taxes, where employers are paying into a scheme based on, you know, their ratings and how often they're laying off to unemploy, you know, or how often they're rendering workers technologically unemployed. We gave those as options, but, you know, ultimately they're both a little challenging, again, due to definite issues and the administrative burdens associated with new taxes and potentially unfairly penalizing businesses that are legitimately more efficient for automating. You know, one could also grant offsetting tax preferences for human workers. So, for example, we could get rid of payroll taxes. If we got rid of payroll taxes, you know, businesses wouldn't have a wage tax based reason to choose a machine over a person. And so that's probably a more appealing system in that it ends the taxation of something socially valuable, namely human labor, and it decreases tax complexity. You know, the problem with doing that is the federal government gets, you know, around 30 or 35% of its tax revenue from payroll taxes. So that would have to be made up, you know, in a significant way. And that could be done any number of ways, including with an automation tax or by increasing income taxes. We ultimately argued that what seems like the fairest solution is to increase capital taxes, which could be, you know, capital gains taxes or corporate tax rates, in part given the benefits that capital is going to be seeing from increased automation, but also arguing that the tax system in general seems fairly heavily weighted towards labor taxation right now.
In deciding whether to enact an automation neutral approach, one thing jurisdictions will probably think about is the potential that the approach causes the owners of the technology to shift their capital investments abroad. Is there a way for jurisdictions to address that that you'd recommend?
I think a couple things about it. So that is, you know, part of the dominant narrative and the reason that labor taxes are favored, which is a couple of reasons. You know, one is it's administratively easier, and two, you know, businesses, for example, are, you know, easier targets for collecting withheld income taxes and more likely to withhold income taxes appropriately, given that it's not their tax liability that they're acting on. You know, but the other being that traditionally economists have thought, well, if we tax labor, people aren't going to stop working. And there aren't that many people who are going to move to low tax jurisdictions to try and avoid taxes. Whereas if we increase taxes on capital, people will flee to low tax jurisdictions. You know, the US and Europe, for example, have historically had fairly high tax rates, and capital has not fled these jurisdictions. And that's because while they may be subject to higher capital taxes, they have very well-developed workforces. They're the largest markets in the world. They have, you know, developed judicial systems and infrastructure. And so there's a lot of positive reasons for people to invest and make a compelling return on investment, even with somewhat higher capital tax rates. You have not seen, for example, all of the capital fleeing to no tax jurisdictions. So in part, I would argue that the narrative that we ought to tax labor over capital because capital will flee is overblown. You know, but there are limits to how much a jurisdiction could raise its capital taxes. You know, another approach to that might be an international treaty on minimum tax rates for things like corporate taxes and capital gains taxes, so that there isn't a race to the bottom as jurisdictions might be tempted to force more taxes on labor versus capital.
Support for this podcast is provided by the University of California Irvine School of Law Graduate Tax Program. Ranked number 1 on the West Coast and number 5 nationwide, this top-ranked innovative program prepares students to practice tax law at the highest level, in the U.S. and abroad. Featuring a low student-to-faculty ratio, cutting-edge technology instruction, and dedicated career support, UCI's graduate tax program helps prepare students for a future in tax law. Program graduates are placed in top tax-related industries, practicing law in many major U.S. cities. Applications are open now. For more information, and to apply to this highly selective program, visit law.uci.edu/gradtax. That's law.uci.edu/gradtax.
This topic touches many different aspects of policy. Would you walk us through some of the other aspects that are not tax as well?
Yeah, it was surprising to me the more I looked into this, the more in different areas of the law, even if you have a person and a machine doing something really very similar or functionally interchangeable, how differently the law treats that. You know, for example, I mentioned taxes on self-driving cars. If my self-driving Tesla runs someone over, and if I run someone over in exactly the same sort of way, you know, the Tesla accident is looked at under a strict liability tort framework, and my accident's looked at under a negligence-based framework. And it probably doesn't make sense to have two totally different systems for determining liability, you know, particularly unfair to whoever got run over, who's just not looking to get run over and wants to be able to collect, you know, compensation equally from whatever causes an accident. Another area that's very topical right now is AI making things, and in particular, sorts of things that get intellectual property protection like patents and copyright. So this year, text-to-image generators have exploded over the internet, taking an academic curiosity to something that has serious commercial importance. And in the United States, if an AI makes a piece of artwork, no matter how valuable it is, that can't get copyright protection right now. That's probably not a good system, given that the Supreme Court has consistently said we have copyright protection to promote the dissemination and generation of creative works, and given that people are now using AI to make creative works and to disseminate them, or people are now using AI in drug discovery and development or materials engineering to invent new products and hoping to commercialize them, but at the moment in the United States, you can't get a patent on that either. Though different jurisdictions are treating it differently, the United Kingdom, for example, does provide copyright protection for that sort of thing. So I argue that actually people would be much better off if the law was neutral to AI versus human behavior, because ultimately the law is generally trying to promote a certain sort of socially beneficial behavior, whether that's not running people over and driving or making creative new works or inventing new drugs. And that we should promote the best way of doing that, whether it's having a person do it or having a machine do it.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And now, coming attractions. Each week we highlight new and interesting commentary in our magazines. Joining me now is Acquisitions and Engagement Editor-in-Chief Paige Jones. Paige, what will you have for us?
Thanks, Dave. We are excited to announce that the submission period for the Tax Notes Student Writing Competition is now open. Each year, we recognize superior student writing on unsettled questions in tax law or policy. Eligible students must be enrolled in an accredited undergraduate or graduate program during the academic year. Visit taxnotes.com/students for more details. In Tax Notes Federal, Patrick Dryson suggests that the ratio of corporate tax receipts to GDP can be a misleading indicator of the race to a tax bottom. Trevor Bowler follows Whirlpool's litigation, analyzing what appear to be the company's two primary arguments on appeal to the Supreme Court. In Tax Notes State, three KPMG practitioners discuss the partnership rules applicable to oil and gas property sales. Joshua Hamlet explores what a reclassified status of cannabis could mean for tax deductions and write-offs. In Tax Notes International, Robert Van Brederode claims that tax competition gets a bad rap and argues that it can fuel innovation, increase efficiency, and reduce waste, among other things. Alexandra Ball considers the VAT registration and compliance challenges facing social media influencers who receive payment or merchandise from brands. In Featured Analysis, Joe Thorndike explores tax reform during Dwight D. Eisenhower's presidency. On the opinions page, Nana Amasarfo reviews a recent lawsuit against Liberty Tax for allegedly cheating customers by luring them with a cash bonus program while secretly increasing their preparation charges. And now, for what's new and noteworthy in our magazines, here is Tax Notes Federal Editor-in-Chief Ariel Greenblum.
Thanks, Paige. I'm here with Elizabeth Stevens, a member in the International Tax Practice at Kaplan & Drysdale. Welcome to the podcast, Liz.
Thanks, Ariel. I'm very delighted to be here.
We're here to discuss your Tax Notes Federal article titled Transfer Pricing's Next Generation, which you co-wrote with two of your fellow members of the Transfer Pricing Committee of the ABA section of taxation. Could you give us a brief overview of the article?
Sure. Yeah. And first, shout out to Iman Kweiler and Nirja Srinivasan, my co-authors. They shared the byline for the article. And then to four of our mentees. So the article is about a mentorship program that we run through the Transfer Pricing Committee that I'll give you a little more detail on in a moment. But four of our mentees from last year's class contributed to the article. So Hannah, Pablo, Chuck, Sandira, congratulations where congratulations are due. The article is, I guess the second in a series, as it's celebrating the second year of a mentorship program that we started during the pandemic in the summer of 2020, launched it in the fall of 2020. So everyone was entirely remote, but it's a mentorship program matching law students and, you know, ultimately we hope graduate economics, business and finance students as well, with in-house corporate transfer pricing and tax professionals as their mentors. And the intent is to give students who otherwise or have an interest in transfer pricing and are maybe taking a transfer pricing class as part of law school or part of a business school program, a more practical operational perspective on, well, what does all of this really mean? You know, what is it? How does one apply this knowledge in the real world? If students are going into advisory roles, they're going to be, you know, transfer pricing attorneys or economists advising businesses, then it helps them to know their clients and to understand, okay, I can give the advice, I can read the law and I can use the evaluate the numbers and tell my client, you know, here's what I think you should do. But what does my, you know, from the client's perspective, how do I actually have to apply that knowledge? What are the systems, you know, that into which I have to embed kind of our transfer pricing methodology? What are the practical challenges with implementing the recommendations that I receive from my advisors? So that was a kind of part of the idea for the program. And our first year, 2020 to 2021, we used the academic year. We had six students, and I would say it worked remarkably well. They all emerged with a great enthusiasm for transfer pricing. Some of them were even working in transfer pricing. And that enabled us to expand the program in its second year to 14 mentor-mentee pairs. So we did that last year. And the article tells the story of that sophomore year of the program, describing, you know, the overall concept of the program, our capstone exercise, which we hold in May as kind of the conclusion of the, you know, the mentorship year, which was an interactive mock competent authority meeting in which the students participated. There was sort of a written component that they had to prepare in advance, working as teams, and then a live negotiation. It was loads of fun. And we asked the students to, invited them to contribute a short piece on their reactions to the program, what their negotiating strategy was, how it was working with their team members. And four of them, you know, provided submissions. And so that, you know, that is what you see in the article, kind of an overview of the capstone. Big thank you to all of our students and their mentors, and then the students' contributions. So we wanted it to be a platform for the students, first and foremost, to get their names out there. And then also a way of recognizing the mentors and acknowledging their contributions of time and wisdom to the program.
What was your favorite takeaway from the mentorship program?
This last year, we held the capstone. We actually held the capstone on my birthday. It was a hybrid event. So we had, I think, 10 of the students here at the firm and several on Zoom. And then some of the mentors came. We had a live audience of ABA tax section members. And It was like the best birthday ever, I have to say. They had so much fun. They were so engaged. They were so smart. They thought on their feet. I mean, I was blown away. And they had a really great time. The mentors had a great time. Everyone in the audience was really excited. So I felt that was really demonstrated our, the success, that what I had hoped to achieve with the program, what we had hoped to achieve with the program and starting it was really working. So I'd say that. And then a colleague forwarded me an email, a colleague who was formerly employed at one of the big four and is on a distribution list for a lot of their tax alerts. She forwarded one to me the other day and said, I thought you'd be interested in this. It was a transfer pricing topic. And I scrolled down to the list of authors, and there in the list was one of our mentees. So she's now on the in the national office for one of the big four accounting firms doing transfer pricing.
That's tremendous. That is tremendous. Thank you. What an opportunity for everyone involved. All right. Before we let you go, where can listeners find you online?
They can find me online on the Kaplan Drysdale website. It's www.capdale.com, or you can email me at estevens@capdale.com. But if you'd like to learn more about the mentorship program, or if someone listening out there would like to be a mentor, please email us at abatpmentoring@gmail.com. We're eager for volunteers.
Very good. Okay. Thank you for joining us on the podcast, Liz.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can find Liz's co-authored article online at taxnotes.com. And be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, Tax Notes, for more in-depth discussions on what's new and noteworthy in tax. Again, that's Tax Notes with an S. Back to you, Dave.
That's it for this week. You can follow me online at TaxStew, that's STEW, and be sure to follow at Tax Notes for all things tax. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for a future episode, you can email us at podcast@taxanalyst.org. And as always, if you like what we're doing here, please leave a rating or review wherever you download this podcast. We'll be back next week with another episode of Tax Notes Talk.
Tax Notes Talk is a production of Tax Notes. You can learn more about us by visiting www.taxnotes.com/podcast. When major media wants the straight story, they turn to Tax Notes. Thank you for listening, and join us again for another edition of Tax Notes Talk. Tax Analysts, Inc. does not provide tax advice or tax preparation services. Nothing in the podcast constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice. A full disclaimer is included in the transcript.